Welcome to New Books in World Affairs, and this is your host, Christian Peterson. And today I have the good fortune of speaking with Jerome Dundum about his new book, Dynasties, A Global History of Power, 1300 to 1800, which is put out by Cambridge University Press. Jerome, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
It's nice to have you here today, and I was wondering before we get going if you could say a few words about your background for the listeners.
Yeah, well, I've been trained as an historian. I'm a professor of early modern history at Leiden University, but from my studies, early studies on, I've always combined history and anthropology. And so I'm a specialist of European history, but I've increasingly been working together with regional specialists, Ottomanists, sinologists, and others who look at the same themes that I'm studying, that I have been studying. And basically, over the last 10, 20 years, I've focused on courts, royal courts, dynastic power, rulership. And so on these themes, I've been developing a collaboration with many people across the globe. And this finally led to the book that we're discussing today.
Yeah, it's an interesting topic. I wish I had read more on it, but you opened my eyes in a lot of ways. And I guess the place to start is why the emphasis on comparison. You seem to be part of this trend in global history to write comparisons across many cultures and different backgrounds. I was wondering if you could say more about the process of getting into the writing a comparative global history.
Well, as a historian of Europe, I've always been active in comparative work. So I started out comparing the courts of France, of Versailles, and of Vienna, the imperial court at Vienna. So comparison, as it were, is the way I always operate as an historian. But I also have been drawn to global history. And there I have to say that the dominant trend in global history seems to be connected rather than comparative history. And comparative history tends to have a reputation of being Eurocentric, being sort of mega jumbo history, not close to people, reasoning from one standard example, mostly Europe, and then jumping to universalist conclusions that in fact take away all the flavor and all the specificities of other cultures. And my feeling is that comparison could work perfectly well if we try to redefine the way we compare. And so connected history, transnational history, transimperial history, histoire croisée, entangled history, they all have the great benefit that they can bring you very close to people. You can really follow a person, an object, or an idea from one place to another and see how persons or ideas change going from one place to another. But in the end, they describe basically elements of the process of globalization, or even to say it a bit more critical, elements of the process of European expansion. Because throughout the last four or five centuries, the expansion of Europe has been sort of the dominant aspect of globalization, or one of the dominant aspects. And I think comparison, without the Eurocentric, without the very sort of distant, standardized, model-like approach that we've seen a lot in earlier decades, just tries to answer quite different questions, really does not try to reconstruct the world as an interconnected group of societies and how they came together, but asks certain questions that hopefully are relevant to all polities or all examples that you discuss, and then try to bring in the picture the very different solutions for these questions, for these problems that can be seen worldwide, globally. And dynastic power seemed to me an almost ideal subject for a global comparison, because it is a relatively universal phenomenon. Almost all polities with a certain level of hierarchy will have one figure, and mostly but not universally a male figure on a throne, will have a group that tries to somehow hold on to power, a dynasty. It will have a social setting, a space, a court where they meet and where a ruler is being served, but also where governance is being organized. And of course, by definition, they all need in one way or another to relate to society at large. Why are these people why are they accepted? Or are they accepted? Or how do they fit in society at large? So I thought this is a wonderful subject because of its spread over over all parts of the world. This is a wonderful subject to approach global history and to try and argue really comparison can work if we find the right questions and if we take distance from a position that really immediately identifies you as somebody primarily or only connected to a certain region of the globe. And so this is basically the experiment of the book. It is an experiment to show that comparative history can really be an essential addition to global history other than what we've seen in the connected history field. They both are important and I would say really very, very necessary for global history, but we should not say, well, comparison is an old-fashioned method. We should no longer use it. I think it's vital. And this statement is heart of the book, I would say.
Yeah, you raised some interesting points. In terms of this idea of having a comparison have like a universal standard that you judge things by and then look at how things relate to it or not, and you kind of raise that issue with this idea of Eurocentrism. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if what, as far as you can tell, I mean, this is a new book, in terms of the reception, are people buying into this and saying this is a great way to do history, or people seem to be more comfortable with the individual case studies and then comparing it to something, I don't know, maybe not normative is the right word, but some type of universal standard.
The sort of complication you always have with comparative history is that people tend to look first at the case they know well. And you have to convince them on the basis of the knowledge you show about their specific case. So let's say sinologists or Africanists or Ottomanists or Europeanists will have the tendency to first look at the pages that deal primarily with their issues. And once you can convince them there, they may be tempted to go further and then really ponder whether the comparison I try to make is more is relevant and interesting for them. So what I've done in is working together very closely with specialists in all these fields, and also not just read their books, but also discuss certain issues with them. Does this work? Is this something that fits into your world? And people have told me frequently throughout the last decade or so, no, this doesn't. This is really something that is specific for or for, let's say, China or for Europe, but you cannot really easily translate it. And so the layout of the book is based on the thought that you have certain categories, certain questions that really can be adapted to each and every of my examples, but that these general questions will lead to immense variety in answers, and that the interplay between general questions, variety, is the essence of what I try to do, because it will show you that, of course, there's people often say comparison about similarity is about similarities and differences. But I think first you see certain similarities and you start comparing, and then you start finding out about differences. But actually, in the similarities, you have to see the differences, and in the differences you have to see sort of the patterns that are behind these apparently very different things, and then comparison really gets interesting and it gets more detailed, and it allows you to get closer to personal experiences, so not to just write about cultures or about huge models, regions of the world, but really about personal experiences in different cultures and then try to connect them to each other. And of course, about reception, I really cannot say so much. The people I've been discussing the book with seem to be happy with my categories and with my concepts. But I'm sure that there will be some criticism, particularly from people who will seriously doubt the theoretical possibility of comparing without really permanently having one example in your mind. And my argument there is we are always universally comparing, as historians, as anthropologists, as scholars in general, because we always have certain specific experiences in our mind and we look at other experiences and we implicitly connect them. And the best way to do this is to not do it explicitly, but to think carefully about your methods, do it explicitly, and try as best as you can to take distance from the images that, of course, everybody has in mind.
Yeah, those are interesting points. And it made me think a lot about my complaints. I read stuff. I'm a specialist in U.S. foreign policy late 20th century, and I read books or textbooks, and I'm like, this should be in it. When there's comparisons done, and I'm like, why isn't this in there? And I got to take a step back and remember that's, they're not doing the same thing. They're trying to find common patterns and not outline every level of knowledge that I have about one particular subject. So I think that's a valuable point to remind people what you're doing in terms of bringing light to broad categories of comparison rather than just specialized knowledge. So I thank you for that. But one of the issues that's raised is by your way you compare do the comparison is the subject of comparing things that seem so different in terms of like a major empire like the Chinese or the Safavids versus smaller kingdoms in Africa or other places that you mentioned, other parts of the world. I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about how you decided to choose your case studies and make the comparison.
Yeah, thanks. I think that's really a very relevant point. And it's also a point where people will tend to be critical because they will tell me, well, however could you think of comparing an African chiefdom with maybe 5, 6, 7, 8, 10,000 people without script in on a very small scale geographically with the Chinese Empire? This doesn't make sense at all. They are so distant in what is sometimes called world historical time or development. And in scale, that it really is absurd to compare these examples. And I hesitated seriously before bringing in Africa because there are all sorts of problems relating to sources that tend to be colonial or outside sources looking on African history or oral history, usually compiled later on. But actually, one of the advisors of one of the presses I proposed the book to told me, well, do so, bring it in. And this was the best advice he could have ever, or he or she could have ever given me, because I think Africa breaks open the easy East-West comparisons and cliches that we've often seen. And just giving you one example that strikes me as relevant and interesting, it's clear to all sinologists that Chinese emperors have a major, let's say, cosmic responsibility for the harmony of the world, for the harmony of heavens, and for even things such as seasons, rainfall, and that sort of thing. And the sacrifices they perform are closely related to this high cosmic responsibility that lasts into the 19th century. And we have personal statements by 19th century Qing emperors who really are quite explicit about their own views on this. And this is exactly one of the specific characteristics of African ritual kingship that we find in many places, the responsibility for rain, for harmony, for cosmic balances. And so here you have you have the two extremes, let's say, on the scale of world historical time development and so on and so forth. And they show that at the heart of dynastic power, in the notions of kingship, there is really a totally parallel concept of kingship. And I find that interesting because it tests and it stretches your ideas about what should you compare? How can comparison work? Taking these very different cases sort of reformulates your criteria of comparison. And sometimes, of course, it does not work. Once you look at systems of government, at how these central courts establish their connections to peripheral regions, to different peoples, then in the Chinese case, there are multiple intermediate layers. There's a huge apparatus where paperwork plays a major role. And in some of my African examples, as one author characterizes it, this is open-air government. This is something that you perform with a group of people whom you can see and relate to directly, and they go back to their villages and they personally represent you in a way. So, of course, scale makes a big difference, but my point is here, in some instances, it makes such a big difference that comparison that it's too distant to really bring together, but you make explicit the difference and it's part of your comparison. And in other cases, the very fact that even these very distant examples show close similarities raises vital comparative issues. For instance, another example, if you allow me,
Of course.
The way, one of the key problems of rulership is how does a ruler deal with his potential successors, princes. This is a very tense relationship because succession gives rights, and rights also entail threats to the incumbent ruler, the one who's in power now. And you get specialists working on African history, sinologists working on Chinese history. You make almost literally the same statement about, well, either you keep these princes close to your court, you keep them under some sort of control, or you send them far away and give them all sorts of tasks as generals or governors or so. But you have these two variants, or keep them close or send them out and far away in particular. And so this is another example how you can say, well, apparently this tension between a ruler and potential successors plays out in similar ways, even in countries, even in polities that are so fundamentally different in most respects. Does that answer your question more or less?
Yes, it does. Those are similar problems that have to be dealt with in similar ways. I mean, they do relate to the issue of how to exercise power effectively. So I think that's well said, what you just did. And I keep coming back to this because you raised the issue in passing a little bit, but I think it's an important question to get at is when you decide to bring in Africa and other societies, you mentioned at times the Aztecs and the Incas, for example, the issue of sources and how you decided to look at those sources in terms of a lot of them come from Europeans. A lot of them are clearly, you know, have built-in biases. And you talked about your editor, the press, telling you to bring them in. I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about how you dealt with those sources dealing with
I think there are
different societies.
Two vital issues is sources and how do you select your examples, and why do you take certain examples and leave out others? Sources are really a major problem because there's never total consistency, total symmetry in sources in comparative history. So even within the European cases I've studied, so Vienna and Versailles, the archive was incredibly good in Vienna and just really in bad shape in Paris. And so I had to use all sorts of other sources, libraries, antiquaries, manuscripts, and so on, to create a balance. So what you try to do is create a balance, create a level of symmetry. And that's particularly difficult in cases where clearly the sources are totally diverse. So Arabic visitors writing about Africa, merchants, missionaries, traders, soldiers, Europeans mostly writing about Africa in the 16th and 17th century, 18th centuries, they clearly have a totally lopsided view. And you have to read through their materials to somehow get to the points where you can think, I really can work with this. Also, we get many compilations. So as in all visitors' reports or travelers' reports, you get people who may not even have been there and just reuse notes written down by others. So you have to be, as always, very critical in using your sources. For the Aztecs and for the Incas, we only have the sources, or we basically the main source we have are the codices that were written, as you will know, by the Spanish missionaries or in consultation with the locals in the 16th century, so after the conquest, basically. And this is all warped in the sense that it tries to make points that are implicit, that are unclear, and we have to find our way to what's behind this. But at the same time, there's archaeology, there's anthropology, there's lots of other materials that are not necessarily based on these written sources that give you some cues. And also the key question would be, do we include them? Or should we say, no, these sources are not really up to a certain level, so let's exclude them. Let's not have the Incas, the Aztecs, Africa, and so on. And that, I think, is unacceptable. And it goes further than this, because most of the sources that I use for Asian history, also published sources, but also the sources that are behind sinology or Ottoman studies or whatsoever, or Mughal or Safavid studies, most of these studies were themselves quite different in nature, are themselves quite different in nature than, let's say, the archival sources that I'm very familiar with for Europe. We have many chronicles, we have many official records, veritable records, as they are called in Chinese history. And these are redacted sources. These are carefully compiled memories of reigns that also have an immense deformation in them. And so the only thing I can say here is the basic necessity will always be to be quite aware of the nature of the sources that you're using and to sometimes read with the grain, sometimes read against the grain, and try to somehow use the material as best as you can, but not to say, well, because of this difficulty, I cannot do comparative history, because then you will all be basically redefined to national historians.
Yeah, I was on a dissertation committee a while ago, and the student in question used that excuse quite a bit. I would ask him, why didn't you look at these sources? And he's like, well, they're biased. They're written from this angle. That's not acceptable. I'm like, you still got to look at them if you want to.
Yeah. All sources are biased. I mean,
So you made me think of that. But you're right. I agree with everything you said there. That's an important point.
Just the other point that I think is connected to this is, why pick some examples and leave out others?
Yeah.
So I had two main guidelines, as it were, there. First of all, for every main theme, so basically my chapter layout, I wanted to include all the major regions of the world. So roughly East Asia, West and South Asia, to some extent Southeast Asia, the island groups there. Europe, North Asia, as far as I could get materials there, not easy. Africa, certainly, and also, as far as possible, the Americas and Polynesia, Melanesia. So, always I used examples from East Asia, South and West Asia, Europe, and Africa. And the others come in more incidentally, because simply the material is more limited. My other argument, and this made Africa more prominent in my book, was to go not so much for the encyclopedic method of getting more and more examples of the same story. Let's say we have Islamicate empires from West Asia to Central Asia, to South Asia, even into Southeast Asia. And at a certain point of time, there's, as it were, an exhaustion of examples. You get the same stories over and over again. And they shift. Of course, they shift from West to South to East. You get different forms of Islamicate empires. But still, some of the examples are then quite familiar. And so what I wanted to do is establish the regional trends, as it were, but always focus on examples that really somehow baffle you, that are different, that show you the model I'm trying to establish, because implicitly are always thinking about patterns and models and that sort of thing. The things that really make this effort more difficult are always the most interesting examples. So a key example for me would be matrilineal succession, matrilineal descent in Africa. So king's sons cannot succeed. Succession has to go through his sister's sons or to a brother born from the same mother or so. This means that the whole notion of dynasty, the whole idea of father to son concentrated vertical succession breaks down, that you get diffuse sideways horizontal forms of succession, that you get circulation among different groups, and that the whole idea of kingship, of royalty, of dynasty itself is in a way shown to be defined in a narrow European cultural way, or narrow Chinese, you can also say, patrilineal, closed, vertical format. And once you see this, you go back to your other examples and you see, well, even in European history, of course, many people will know this, but also in European history, matrilineal descent implicitly or explicitly plays a major role. And you start looking with the experiences from the one example that you chose because it broke through your categories, and you start redefining your categories. And this, to me, really has been the joy of making this comparison.
Yeah, that was a very interesting part of the book. I knew some of it, but not nearly in the detail that you bring, and it really was thought-provoking. But before we get into some of the major arguments of your chapters, I thought it would make sense to go over how you chose the periodization of the book in terms of deciding to take this time period and use it to use your case studies to explain dynastic power. I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about periodization.
Yeah, well, that's, again, it's a very relevant point because for this theme, I think you could really take world history as a starting point. Of course, for practical reasons, this is hardly feasible. But it could you could bring in earlier examples and you could just skip the whole period and say, well, this is dynastic power tout court. It's all over the place. Of course, that would have been far more difficult to organize, and your examples are even more spread out and you get thinner, so I didn't want to do that. And it made sense for me in a way to combine it with the connected perspective that we started out discussing and to say, well, we need sources. We also, I use sources a lot that represent the views of others, of travelers, of people moving from one place to another. And then clearly, one possible starting point, which I in the end went for, is the period that we sometimes label as the Pax Mongolica, the period just following on the major Mongol conquests, that restored, as it were, a unity, or restored or created, I maybe should say, a unity along the Eurasian continent that stimulated movement for people's movement eastwards, westwards, and that also generated lots of sources. And this gets more intense, of course, in the later 15th and 16th and 17th century. So the connected world provides me with sources, and the connections get stronger in the 13th, 14th century, or after the Mongol conquests. And then, of course, the connections keep getting stronger in the 18th and 19th and 20th century. But then, of course, from the later 18th century onwards, I wouldn't position it much earlier than that, European hegemony is unchallenged. Of course, there's still China, the Ottomans are still independent, Japan keeps its independence, but no single example, and the Chinese case here in the 19th century would be a staggering example, no single example can be given of an empire that really follows its own track, is not seriously dominated, I shouldn't say, but seriously moved and forced in a certain direction by the European presence. Of course, for the African polities, this would be true much earlier. In the 16th century, and slavery is a key issue from the late 16th or the 16th and 17th century, and some of the kingdoms I'm looking at were based on the wealth created through slavery because they themselves were organized or profited from slavery. So this is it's not an entirely consistent point in the sense that you could say this is before European influence and this is after or so. But still, where the European impact was so strong that it redefined separate polities as colonies or as groups under European control, then the comparison loses its force because you're looking at many variants of cultures that are being redefined in a colonial setup. And that doesn't really give me the type of examples that I would want to have without being naive in the sense that you deny earlier contexts. Contexts are of all times and all places, and influences are always quite important. But really, I think that from 1800 onwards, a bit earlier, particularly after the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars, and with the global hegemony of Europe is so strong that you can no longer compare in the same way.
Yeah, I think that approach makes perfect sense. I think it's well done too. And when you set up all the stuff we've gone over in the interview, you set it up in the introduction and it's well done. And then you get into the actual chapters that you frame in the introduction as concentric circles that start at the center and then move its way out to explain the functioning of dynastic power. So I was wondering if we could just go through maybe perhaps some of the main points that you make in the chapter, starting with this idea of the ruler versus the position versus the person, this ideal of what a king is and what a king can do in the system.
Yeah.
And you make a number of arguments, but it's interesting that on some level you come to the conclusion that kings do not always have as much power, or queens, and even if the case may be, have as much power as that we sometimes think they did.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, maybe just if you allow a few words about these concentric circles.
Oh, of course. Yeah,
as I mentioned before, comparative history, global history, sometimes gets very distant from human experiences. And what I've tried to do consistently in this book is to somehow get as close to the people involved as you can. And so also the layout of the book, it starts, the heart of the book is the person who's, as it were, on the throne. And then you move to his immediate or her immediate kin, family, relatives, potential successors. Then you move to the social environment of these people, and then you move to the realm at large. So you want to stay close to people and close to experiences in this layout. And this, of course, maybe is most extreme in the first example that you're referring to. You underline that I somehow question the view of omnipotence that we often attribute to earlier, let's say, pre-revolutionary rulers. And there's, I say, this is also the tension between person and position. There is an immense tendency, and it's also a tendency that's still strong in history textbooks and overviews, to somehow fail to distinguish between the ambitions and the show of power of pre-modern rulership. Of course, this is power that is exclaimed in a sometimes extravagant way, that is, it's phrased very often in as being invulnerable to almost anything. These are very strong figures. They are entitled to do almost anything or many things in any case. And we fail to see the fact that this is an attempt to demonstrate something that in practice works entirely different. These people, whether they try to govern big empires or small states or small polities, their means of communication were extremely limited. Their means of coercion could be big, but then they could never be used consistently throughout their region, throughout their realm. This was all actually their power was extremely limited. So in a technical way, their infrastructure, their power, their communication, their coercive power, they were all relatively limited. And this is not the key of the chapter, because this is, yeah, I think a well-known fact for people who study pre-modern or early modern history is that we tend to overstate the power of people on the throne. Also really important is, I think, two things at the same time. These figures tended to take the catalogue of virtues that was imposed on them as children quite seriously. And they were intimidated by the fact that they had to be all these things at the same time. They had to guarantee harmony with heavens, but also among parties at court. They would have to be the ideal ruler to control all their passions, to be many things at the same time that tend to be totally inconsistent. So to be stern and strong, and to be liberal and merciful, and to be a spendthrift at the same time, not spend too much money because you don't want to overtax the people. So all these demands are entirely inconsistent and too heavy. And still, you get the impression these figures seriously wanted to adhere to this. And the fact that there were so many total misfits, which I think is easy to find out if you look at the history of dynastic power, many people just could not perform this role adequately or actively or successfully, is partly related to the fact that the demands were so high, and that these demands and this position of kingship, this position that could never be challenged, did not mean in practice that the persons on the throne could not be challenged. They were challenged permanently. They were, I guess, and there's a nice view here, Clifford Geertz, the famous anthropologist, he said, well, let's think of these kings as the kings of chess. So, yeah, of course, it's all about the king, but the king is not the main actor. Any other, maybe not the pawns, but any of the other chess players, any of the other parts of the game of chess has more maneuverability, has more freedom than the king. So everything is about the king, but the king's freedom is extremely limited. And this is something that you see confirmed permanently in sources and in anything you read about kingship. And also what comes in is we tend to think of figures who rule are usually in our age come in at an age of, well, maybe not the maximum of their powers, not at the height of their powers, but they will be chosen at a certain point. And they may stick to power a bit longer than is healthy for them and for their countries, but they will not be chosen as presidents or so while they're children. And the specificity of dynastic power is that you get children on the throne, and you get greybeards on the throne. That's actually, again, about strong and weak figures, okay? About strong and weak kings. We tend to generalize a king's power on the basis of two things. The power of a king or queen at the height, so during full physical and intellectual maturity. And the second criterion is often, well, success. So were there any results being achieved or so in this period? But we tend to forget two things, that the longest part of the lives of many rulers were really as children or as old, sickly and insecure people. And also a thing that we can also say about some modern governments, it's really often ridiculous to say, well, these are the results of a certain period of rule, and this tells us something about the qualities of this or that king or queen, because frequently these things are not even so closely connected. There's political contingency, there are huge developments that cannot be controlled by a single figure, and so our judgments, our views of these figures from the past tend to be warped, I guess.
Yeah, that really made me think when you raise those issues on a couple levels. You use this idea of the draining of powers of kings and queens, and I think that it's a very appropriate way of looking at it. I thought in terms of how even in, you know, the American system anyways, presidents are always told they have a limited time to get their agenda passed before it basically dissipates. And that's certainly something that goes on. And the way you describe, and this goes for the whole book, but I'm just throwing out ideas here. I'm not saying this is the truth or anything, but it made me think sometimes that movies, like the worst Hollywood movies, sometimes are closer to the truth than how courts actually worked than textbooks. When you have like these treatments of like world history textbook talk about the absolute power of Louis the 14th, and they kind of lose sight of all the manipulations going on in the background, and you know what information actually gets put before the king that you see.
Yeah,
you know, even in like Game of Thrones, you see this. But so I was wondering about movies are actually more.
Well, there's The Last Emperor. Bertolucci's movie, which I think is a great movie, and the thing that I would have as comment on it is. Pouilly, who then becomes emperor, you see him being trained as a young boy and his play with the eunuchs. That's a totally plausible image that he gives. But then you have to remind yourself, this is the same story for all these earlier emperors. So it's not necessarily relevant only or mostly for this person who becomes the last emperor, but it would be the same story of any youngster sitting on the throne anywhere. You have a group around you, and so Bertolucci's movie stresses sort of the it's the end of empire. There's revolution, there's republic. You trace this figure throughout this movie, but the start of the movie basically could be transposed to the 13th century, and it would still make sense.
You have these images. I believe, I think it's Louis the 14th who was supposed to give a speech when he was 9 or something, or when he started crying, or having to meet a Dutch diplomat when he was a child. The Dutch diplomat was like,
so you
16.
Want to show that the image in the Fronde when he spoke to the Parlement de Paris, and he had his speech prepared, and then he loses the text and he breaks out in tears. And so this is relevant to me because what we always say is the king a few years later in the same Parlement de Paris, and this is a famous quote, and it's one of these many historical quotes that are totally inaccurate, just plainly wrong. The king's meeting his parlementaire in Paris, so the great judges of the realm, says, "L'état c'est moi." Well, this is a made-up quote. He never said anything close to it. But what we tend to do in history is find the images, and this sometimes happens in films too, find the quotes, the sound bites, the images that really confirm a certain cliche or image that we want to be confirmed, and that we do not spend enough time to really look for the plausibility of these images. And so what I try to do in the book is reduce these kings to what they are, persons like you and me, and see how they could function, how they were hampered, how they were restricted, how they were intensely frustrated, how some of them, who actually started out as reasonably sensible and intelligent people, were so frustrated by their limited roles and by all the complications they encountered that they became either really violent, awkward figures, or that they entirely withdrew into their own secluded sphere in the inner part of the court. And what you want to show is that even very strong figures like Louis XIV, like Ottoman Sultan Suleiman, like the Kangxi Emperor of the Qing Dynasty, they all experience the same restrictions, the same complications. And of course, in any specific context, this will play out differently. But there are certain restrictions that you really, also anybody looking back in time to this period of history, should step beyond the idea of, oh, these were so powerful figures, they could do anything they like. No, they were in very many ways immensely restrained in what they could do.
Yeah, it's all very good stuff and important points to think about more than perhaps we sometimes do. And in the second concentric circle, you move to reproduction and succession. And what stands out in this chapter in my mind, I mean, there's many points, I'm not by any means exhausting them, is you focus on the limits of primogeniture, but you also bring in a lot about the role of women, how they played and how dynasties unfolded and succession issues. I mean, even things like the use of harems by Islamic empires is a very interesting part of this chapter. And I was wondering if you could say a little more about that.
Yeah. First of all, there's a big jump from the first chapter to the second chapter. The first chapter starts out with literary tracts about ideal kingship, and women are hardly anywhere to be found there. And so there is this tendency to look back on history and look at these predominantly male rulers and then to forget that women were very present. And in any dynastic context, I would say women are always very strongly present, although in very different roles. And this is what I try to make clear in this chapter, and to look also at very different positions. So women formally ruling as the sovereign, this is really the exception globally. Women who have a key position as mothers, as queen mothers. I think this is probably the strongest position that women hold in dynastic power constellations across the globe, although there are major differences here between queen mothers who have minor sons and who can rule or as regents in Europe or in China or in some other parts of the world, as Valida Sultans in the Ottoman case, and reign mates or queen mothers who rule permanently side by side with the king as maybe not entirely equal, but in most respects equal power holders in many African examples. And then there are daughters and sisters. There are many categories to consider, and I try to consider them all carefully in the book. We have to keep in mind, though, that there are two, I think, major divergences. You mentioned harem-based courts and polygyny. I'm not a fan of pointing to the European exception, because I think we usually tend to overstate it. But it is relevant to note that Christian Europe is the only case that I've been able to trace in my period throughout the globe where dynastic reproduction was not polygynous, where it was monogamous, where succession was primarily based on legitimate succession through monogamous marriage. There are all sorts of intermediate cases where marriage and concubinage are combined in the Muslim and the Islamic case, also in China. But all other examples of rulership go together with polygyny, with many women present. And so that raises all sorts of questions about what were the which structural differences did this create, or did it create structural differences? It did have an immense impact on the structure of courts, because polygyny usually dictates an inner part with women but without men, or with eunuchs, sort of the intermediate category, that is restricted to most other males, or often to all other males, except of course for the ruler himself, and usually for young princes. So this creates a different dimension of access, decision making. And I've pondered the question, does it really make a fundamental difference? And in the end, I hesitate to underline this. I think some of the key problems were similar in Europe and in all the other examples I can find. So it is important to note there are key differences here, but it does not create a different world or so. But it's still an important conclusion to say, well, this was, here is a very clear, very outspoken difference. Yeah, about women, one other point I found interesting is, first of all, across the globe, they usually step in, not because they are the preferred candidates, but because there's no male candidate present.
Yeah.
On the other hand, once they step in as sovereign rulers, you see that they can change the perception, or that they can change political practice, in the sense that in Southeast Asia, in the sultanates of Patani and Aceh, you have a succession of women rulers. In early Japan, there's a succession of women rulers. There are several African examples where there's a succession of women rulers who are really then the preferred candidates on the throne. But then in a generation or two or three or four, you see that it shifts back to accepted male power as the common form. So, but I found interesting the fact that women can apparently, through their example and through their influence, maybe also generate at least 80 years or more of women succession on the throne. But then it disappears again, and the males come back. Now,
Go ahead.
So please, no, you go ahead.
Well, I also found it interesting. I didn't know about this at all, about the role in the Safavid Empire, about, I think it was the daughters who became advisors to kings and really were influential in divvying out advice and trying to frame things for the rulers. That's not something that I'd know much about at all, but it's very interesting to read.
Yeah, what I find interesting is that I want to define cases where women had not so much indirect, informal influence through their husbands or through the rulers or through others, but also just differentiate sharply. In many cases, women had formalized influence, were really played a key role. But and so I try to differentiate a bit, not talk about powerful women in history or so, but to consider the categories, the positions they could have, and differentiate more sharply between them. And also, well, the Safavid case is also is interesting because there are powerful women there. What you can see, for instance, is clearly, and it's an interesting question too, that you can clearly see the nomadic Central Asian peoples, so the Mongols, the Manchus, and others, they tend to have a quite strong position for women. And once these nomadic peoples move out and conquer China with its strong patrilineal tradition, or move into West Asia and mix with traditions there, with the Islamicate traditions, you see that there is a tendency for women to become slightly less central to the polity. The Safavids are an interesting case because they cling to these traditions to some extent of a role for females, and they also allow succession through women in some cases. So it's not preferred form, but they allow it. And so I want to define very precisely how you can trace the changes of female power also in when these peoples, when these dynasties move from one part to another and have to adapt to different forms. So even I don't mention it in my book, but the Jochits, so the most northwest branch of the Mongols, at one point considered electing a female Khan. And then apparently it is said that the local governors who were against it had mostly an Islamic background. So here you see how the mixture, how the of a certain two traditions can create a difference.
Interesting. I didn't know that. Wow. And as far as, I mean, after chapter two, you move on to really the hornet's nest of the court and groups and balances, as you call your circle. And there's so much we could go over. I mean, I've taken a lot of your time, and you've given us a lot of great information. But what strikes me in this chapter is just the complexities of trying to keep power balanced and dealing with different factions. And you also, the way that you portray Louis XIV at Versailles is different than how it's been taught by a lot of textbooks and a lot of a lot of teachers. So I was wondering if you could just give us a small feel for what your conclusions are in this very good chapter.
Yeah, well, Louis XIV is let's say used to be the core of my research with the Habsburgs. So I try not to say too much about him in the book.
Fair enough.
But what's true is that what we tend to look at a few examples in world history, and Louis XIV is prominent among them. And then we say, well, we get the view of the Gilded Cage. We get the view of the court as a place where it's presented as a temple, Temple de la Gloire, a temple of glory, where you have this key figure at the heart who controls everything, who is at the heart of a very precise machinery of ceremonial, of rituals. And then always the French examples of the lever and the coucher are mentioned. There's the view of the court as a cage where rebellious nobles were, as the term goes, domesticated, as it were, herded together. And there's the view of divide and rule. Now, in the last part of the chapter, I look at these three metaphors, because they are nothing more than metaphors, or metaphors are very relevant, but we should know that these are metaphors. The temple and the role of ceremony in ruling, and I come to the conclusion, well, of course, incidentally, you will use ritual appurtenances and ceremony. You will permanently use them as an outward show to show people, here I am, this is what I am. And most kings were, even if they deeply believed in these in this role, they were still quite keenly aware of the impact of a great show. So that's one point. But ceremony is not so much a field where you can easily control elites or manipulate elites, as it is often been, as it has often been stated for Louis XIV. And I find the same in his case as I see in many other cases. This is something that is a constraint rather for the figure in the center, who has to perform a certain role, who is at the heart of the observation of many people, and whose, let's say, his options, his potential to take distance from the role he's playing is really quite limited. And so it's not the temple is not a place where you can easily put down somebody and promote another, as it has frequently been stated in on the French court and other courts. And it could go into great detail here, but just maybe one example. And why not give the French example of the lever and the coucher? So the morning and evening rituals, we always see them as sort of a highly artificial restriction of access, and so complicated, so many rules. Actually, what they reflect is the traditional French reputation of familiar kingship. Any nobleman has the right to enter. And this was even greatly debated and challenged in the 16th century, where Henry III, the last Valois king, introduced a new court order, and he wanted to try to keep these noblemen away from himself. Don't bend over me during my meals. Don't just bump into my room. I need to make all sorts of arrangements here. And so the background of these domestic forms of behavior were not so much ceremony, but were actually the very fact that a king could not separate himself from his elites and his nobles. He needed to be there, and were based on familiarity and ease of access rather than on ceremonial rules. Now, I shouldn't go on too long about this and maybe move to the cage idea, where there's the view that, well, you bring all these nobles together in Versailles, or to jump to the other famous example, you force all the daimyo in Tokugawa Japan to come to Edo and to pay their homage to the shogun. There's more to say about this, particularly about the Tokugawa case, in that, of course, people want to go to the court because it's a place where you can obtain all sorts of benefits. It's a center of redistribution. What Louis XIV in practice did was forbidding or sending away many people. So what he's really an exception there. He was able to reduce the numbers of his court, which had inflated immensely during a period of political crisis during the reign of his mother, Anne d'Autriche. And basically, when you see in Europe, and this may be different elsewhere, in Europe, when you see an explosion, you will know here's a phase of political crisis and weakness of the figure in charge. Whereas reduction of numbers means, well, here's a figure who holds the reins in his hand and who's really able to somehow reduce costs. This is all about budget reduction. Not only about budget reduction, it's also about making court office prestigious and attractive. Is too many people, once too many people hold office, the highest nobles will say, well, this is not for me. I'm not really, why should I go? So if you send away most, if you keep it limited and attractive for a small group, then you have a chance of bringing these people in. And this was done more with attraction than with force, I would say. And it was very limited to an upper group that in the long run dominates the French state as a whole in regional government, in the army, in diplomacy, and in the 18th century also in central decision making. So yeah, the old story actually here is quite wrong. But still, the image of the cage is relevant for Tokugawa Japan, but it's different again, because you do force the daimyo to come together in Edo, but you give them full reign, full leeway in their own domains. So they come to the center, and their travel back and forth to the center is really of great importance for Tokugawa Japan, but in their own domains, they are really very powerful. And the shoguns have no interest in really undermining or reducing their powers there. And actually, the whole metaphor of the cage comes maybe from the Ottoman court, where successors, so the members of the House of Osman, the princes and the brothers of the sons and brothers of ruling sultans, were brought together in the harem and could no longer move outwards, were no longer expected to govern, to fight, or whatsoever, really secluded there. And this form of impotence, form of seclusion, it clearly was not meant to include the nobility or the great lords, but this was only about those who could ascend the throne. And this variant can be found in some parts of Africa, notably in Ethiopia. And you can say, in general terms, the ones who are closest to succession are the ones most likely to be under some form of strict control in dynastic context, because simply they are the most dangerous rivals, far more dangerous than anybody else. So that's one. That's the point about the cage and the arena. Yeah, I do think, of course, even in contemporary politics, dividing rule by dividing will be practiced by people. It's one of the standard ploys of any figure in power. And again, here, courts are always about distribution de grâce, as the 17th century French quote would have it about. The ruler is the fountain of honors. He distributes ranks, titles, offices, and what you do is giving some more, others less, and to somehow make sure that you will not create rivals. And you can do this at the individual level, promoting somebody who's very loyal, demoting or not giving somebody his or her due, mostly his due, who appears to be not entirely loyal. This game is being played permanently. And then you can incidentally do it at the level of social groups. So you have a very strong landed elite or so, a nobility, and you raise others to higher power. Yeah. Exiles, religious disciples, an example like the Ottoman Defterme system. So you have you create an elite based on slavery, and you reduce in power other elites. You bring in at the heart of power new groups who start out as your supporters, but then of course even all these groups very quickly develop their own dynamic as elites, will establish their own vested rights, will compete with you as a ruler for these rights, and you will be in, maybe not in the same situation, but in a structurally similar situation. Now, my key point here, and this again brings me to your earlier question about the power of kings, is that kings can do only so much. You need to be extremely talented, careful, and also maybe awkwardly violent to use these instruments effectively. And you can do so only for a short term. In the end, they will always somehow, these elites, keep up with you or will turn out to be the stronger party. And you have to keep in mind here that there are many examples of figures who are maybe able to deal with these challenges effectively for 5 years, for 10 years or so, but then you lose grip, lose track and fall back. And that there are many others who simply never ascend to that level. They are just objects of the elites around them, yeah, rather than active figures pulling ropes and acting as arbiters. And so this is what you always have to keep in mind. It's even for a single strong figure, it's not a lifetime experience. And putting all these, I've seen so many records of kings and queens throughout the world, putting them all side by side, you are struck by the many who really could not compete and who were probably, and I think that's a really relevant category too, who were the most successful of many of the most successful, actually just complied in a friendly way with the demands of the inner core of advisors, were represented outwardly as powerful and good and just rulers, but in fact were, as it were, organized. The mise-en-scène was in the hands of their immediate environment. They were not the powerful figures. And we can never really, this is one of the key problems, I think, we can never really find out who was the actor here, who were the actors here, and who were just the ones who were being manipulated. We have examples in all directions.
Yeah, it's hard to pin down.
Yeah, you need sources, and in some cases, you really have sources. And once you have sources, in the incidental cases where you have rich materials, you can always find out, even in the case of very strong rulers, there's a balance. There is always this group of people proximate to power who are the movers and the shakers. And once you know their interests, and I think you cannot always prove this, but you just need to take for granted, you need to look for these people and for their interests before you can give a balanced, adequate image of how courts function.
Yeah, there's a lot to chew on in that chapter. We're just scratching the surface. I also liked the stuff you had on the Qing dynasty and how the emperors weren't as secluded as treatments of European descriptions or other descriptions.
Well, that's one other point. It's easy to jump to, let's say, East-West cliches and definitions. So it would be very common to say, well, European rulers were relatively accessible. They moved out, they invited people into the heart of their courts, which to a certain extent is true because these courts weren't harem-based. And so the male domain around a ruler's private quarters was relatively more accessible than the female harem domain around many rulers in Asia. So there's a core, there's an element of truth in this. But I find it funny to listen to the Safavid Shah Abbas I, who pokes fun at European rulers and says, well, he pokes fun mostly at the Spanish Spanish kings who were he was thinking about at the time, and said, well, they just sit in their palaces, they lost the liberty to move around in their cities. And actually, we see many examples of rulers in West Asia who are relatively accessible, who accept the logic that they need to show themselves in the March to Friday prayer, that they need to be accessible to some point. And there are others who are really totally inaccessible in Europe, as well as in West Asia, as well as in East Asia. And then the Qing are interesting because they, as an outside dynasty, as a nomadic people, Manchus, well, they were no longer nomadic, but they conquered China, they came in, and they bring in a fresh air of movement, of battlefield experience, of mobility, of personal valor, and they clearly take more initiatives, they are more accessible. But even here, the personal dimension, we have earlier Chinese rulers in the Ming who also want to move outward, who also wanted to be mobile, to be military heroes. But then you can say there is a cultural tradition that keeps them within certain bounds, or creates conflict when they themselves do not want to respect these boundaries. So there is a culture that can, of course, have a major impact on these figures. But then the variety of these characters on the throne throughout the regions that I've been looking at, I can find easily accessible or very secluded figures in Europe, in West Asia, and East Asia, and also over time. There's another image particularly relevant for Europe that you say, well, late medieval rulers were so boisterous, friendly, familiar. And then over time, they withdraw in their pleasure castles and people can no longer access them. And yeah, there is maybe a heart of truth in this. We see these palaces, these hunting lodges all over Europe, but they were often quite accessible. And again, here, the personal dimension is very powerful. Some figures just like being watched and they like the show. Others find it really a horrible experience. So to make a long story short, the personalities, the characteristics of individuals on the throne, yeah, of course, it's a cliche, but they were very relevant and they break through regional models and long-term developments.
Yeah, when I read that, I thought, I mean, it's not related to your book, but Queen Victoria basically went incognito after her husband died, and just like secluded herself and wore black for I don't know how long, for years, and she then the system kept going, even when she didn't want to be bothered and was in mourning.
Yeah, that's a great example, and I think it relates directly to some of my themes. So to life cycle experiences, you get older, you have an experience like losing your husband. We have the same story of Maria Theresa of Austria, of the Habsburg Empress. So these are formative experiences, and they will change your position fundamentally. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's interesting, and it's a good segue in chapter four. You deal with the realm and how one of the big questions. I mean, there's a lot in this chapter as well, but how did the dynasties project their power, and why did people follow it? Why did people who are governed relatively lightly, I mean, maybe even a lot lightly by modern standards, buy into the system that was obviously based on some level of inequality and that some people were better than others? I think that's an interesting argument, how you deal with that question. And there are other questions in the chapter,
it's the key question, and it's the most difficult question to answer. You can easily somehow provide an overview of all sorts of contexts that you can find out between courts and the wider world that they governed. And your question is difficult because what we have primarily is a top-down view here. What we primarily have is texts, images, palaces and everything, but also ritual descriptions of a show as it was intended by the ones who organized it. And you need other sources to really come to the heart of how did people see this? My sources are important here. So my experiences, wherever I can, and this is mostly my European background, wherever I can reconstruct perceptions, reception of all this dynastic show, and what you see is basically two things. And I think this is relevant on a global scale. On the one hand, we should really keep in mind that the basic dynastic sort of hierarchical setup is something that is inherent to the cultures that we're looking at. This is how they function. This is how they see their own households. This is how they see the world where they live. This is how they see the heaven. This is how they see order in general. So there's no sense of this in principle is oppression or so. There's an overall sense of this is how the world should be. At the same time, there's clearly a strong feeling about that kings can be very, very, very bad. And that kings can really destroy lives, can destroy countries. And so you have this Janus-faced view of politics. On the one hand, this is the system that we base. On the other hand, it frequently goes wrong in a terrible way. And actually, I think we have the same Janus-faced situation in modern politics. Well, many people in many countries would say, I accept democracy. It's the best I can sort of imagine how it works, but I hate politicians, and I hate these bureaucratic centers. I hate the Washington Beltway. I hate Brussels. All our politicians are liars. This is the explanation for the popularity of populists. So basically, and this is just the most abstract general answer, basically I think this is similar in the period that I'm looking at, but also there are quite concrete ways connecting forms of representation, you could say. The easiest form of representation is just hospitality. Allow people to come in to eat, to sit at your table, give them presents, accept presents from them. This is a center of exchange. This is a hub of exchange that in smaller realms does not include only elites, but includes really not entire populations, but for instance, all villages, all regions. So there is this sense of belonging too. You're entitled to go there. You're entitled to eat there. You are entitled to hold certain offices that, for instance, in African courts can bring in a certain region or a certain craft or a certain hereditary lineage. They all have the right to be there at court and to have certain privileges. They all have the right to partake in the bounty of the court in one way or another, not just sitting at the table, but also just getting certain gifts, getting certain privileges, and this will attach many groups to the court. And there, the variety across the globe is interesting. I think in Europe, we have this what we still have the you know the the orders, the distinguished service orders, that sort of thing. You still have all sorts of medals and so on. Of course, this is a typically monarchical dynastic element where you can say we reward peoples, and we in my period we also give them an order of chivalry or so, which brings in the right to attend certain meetings, the right to come to certain major occasions, and you have hundreds and sometimes thousands of people who enjoy these honors. Whereas I do not find an exact parallel for these things in most of the other courts I'm looking at. But one of the grounds, I would say, for harem-based courts is not the fact that a ruler is an extremely lustful figure. In fact, reproduction is often quite rigidly controlled, but that women are also molding together societies. We have in African contexts chiefs sending their daughters to the harem and getting wives from the harem. So there's a two-sided system of exchange of women. And this can be very friendly, and it can also have a more of a hostage character. The Mughal rulers of India, they bring into their harem, lots of Rajput princesses, the Indian nobles they were gradually integrating and conquering. And they had all sorts of groups there that were also part of their attempt to bring together these realms under their rule. And they, again, also gave women to their loyal servants. Of course, the problem here is that you use women as exchange material, as objects, rather than as acting figures. And I have other parts in the book where I underline very strongly this. So I find interesting one minor example here. We get the Ashanti king in the early 20th century. He's exiled to the Seychelles, and he lives an entirely monogamous life there. In 1924, he's restored to a certain level of power in Ashanti, in the Ashanti Federation. And the first thing, or one of the first things he does, is restoring the harem, because he explains this is the basis of our polity. This brings together the peoples, because it is the connection between all these chiefs, all these important figures within the Ashanti Federation, and the power of the Ashanti Hene, the king. So it shows that this is another moment, form of connecting. And you move to the great rituals. All the great rituals in all these polities and empires are really connected to the basic ritual religious life cycle that anybody can recognize. Whether it would be the Christmas and Easter cycles in Europe, whether it would be the cycles in the Islamic world, or the grand sacrifices in China, or the rituals in Japan, there's always a very clear connection to the everyday life of people. This is what happens now. Even if you can't see it, you know these great rituals take place at the same time. At court in Japan, nobody could see it, what the emperor did. In China, the rituals were secluded. In West Asia, Europe, many people flocked to see them. But still, there is a certain resonance, consistency throughout society in what was performed at the center there. Of course, then you reach a point where there really is an important difference in scale and world historical time. One of the themes we mentioned at the beginning. Yeah, a small African polity can bring together in active interaction all the relevant people, all the relevant elites, as it were. Whereas in China, with millions, 100 million under the Ming, or by the late Qing, 300 million, you need an immensely complicated bureaucratic apparatus, and you have a system that's based on writing, on evaluation, on very highly formalized rankings and rewards. But that also brings together realms, and you see Europe is a latecomer in these bureaucratic apparatuses, if you want to use the word bureaucratic, a relative latecomer. But in West Asia and East Asia, they have a long history, a longer history. And finally, the key problem here of most forms of pre-modern power, almost all forms of dynastic power, is delegation and gradually losing power. And this connects also to what we see as the dynastic cycle. In the Arabic world, Ibn Khaldun and other writers speak about dynasties do not take longer than 3 or 4 generations, then they will dwindle, others will take over, fresh people from the desert will conquer and will become urbanized. Becoming urbanized, they become used to luxury, they lose their power, and others will take over. So you get an ongoing movement. The Chinese dynastic cycle says something similar in different terminology with a different... But also stressing that early rulers in a dynasty tend to be strong, and then they lose morality, they become luxurious, they exploit their peoples, and they lose the mandate of heaven. Now, what I think is, if you take distance from this normative view, this very powerfully normative view of dynastic power, but just keep in mind the problems of delegation, the fact that you start out with your own group of followers. For a Chinese dynasty as the Qing, they bring in their own group of followers. There's very strong coherence here. Then these people in many dynasties, they need to be rewarded. They need to be turned into elites. Then they gradually drift away from central power. They develop their local power bases. And in the end, they make dynastic power almost impossible. And this whole machinery of giving and keeping close to the center and rewarding is, I think... An attempt, maybe not always so conscious, but an attempt to keep attached to this dynastic center, these intermediate elites. And of course, for the people at large, for the populace, the rewards were less attractive, and the punishments could be quite horrifying. Not throughout the whole country, usually because of reasons of scale and limited power. But here, of course, they were not the ones. Yeah, maybe in the Chinese case, they would get some support in cases of hunger. They would get tax reductions. They would get all sorts of, in times of crisis, they would get some support, and particularly metropolitan populations, always vital for dynasties, because they needed to first convince these groups to remain quiet or to accept rule. They could expect to be regularly sort of get some rewards too. But on the whole, the question is, why did all these populations adhere to it? And then the key thing is the point I started out with. It's a mixture of, as any polity, there's always coercion somewhere, also for the intermediate elites. There's always pragmatism. You get rewards if you fit in. And there always is, and we tend to underestimate this, there always is a shared ideal. You want to belong to this. You think this is as the world should be organized. And then, of course, what to do with the bad kings? And there we have many different examples, from formal procedure of dethronement to actually the idea that's most powerful in Europe before the age of revolutions. Well, once you get a bad king, that's God punishing you for your misbehavior, and the only thing is to do accept it and wait until the king will get his punishments from higher authorities, so from the heaven.
You raised a lot of issues, and it's a good segue to the your conclusion, in terms of you write a lot about why monarchical power begins to ebb as you move further on in history, in terms of the rise of the modern state. And you can say more about that if you want. But what I'm interested in is what this study, in your conclusion, you address this issue, what it tells us, this study of power, how it has some relation to what's going on in the world today in terms of how people understand power. The things that come into my mind are things like how Americans seem to be very interested in what's going on with the royal family.
Yeah.
They're interested in celebrity, things like this, in terms of, lobbying and corruption and politics.
Yeah.
You bring all these, I was wondering if you could just say a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I think these are interesting issues. What I find flabbergasting, actually, is the fact that that royalty still exerts a fascination to many people. Whether they live in a monarchy or whether they live in a republic, for some reason. So I've always approached the subject from a certain distance, as an anthropologist, basically. I've never been attracted or appealed by, let's say, the appurtenances of royalty. I find it intriguing because I have little or no connection to it. But for some reason, in modern times too, there still is this, and I think you rightly point out, is there's a sense that you also, you see the same with movie stars, maybe with sport heroes, with celebrity on the whole. There is this fascination. I think that's, to me, an intriguing issue, but I cannot say too much about it. I think you can say it's like, it's a leftover of some kind. But what I find interesting is the fact that people, how do people relate to power? They quickly relate to persons in power. That seems to be a general situation. It's easier, and this is basically Louis XIV wrote interesting memoirs. Well, he didn't write them entirely by himself, but he also says, well, people may not be appealed by learned treatises, but they would want to see something. They like spectacle. They want to see a show. They want to see a person elevated above the others. And there still is something to it. We can more easily relate, or many people can more easily relate to persons than to ideologies or ideas. And my impression is that this has been, let's say we have a 19th century, early 20th century, where maybe you could say, this is too, it's an overstatement, it's like the public sphere, Jürgen Habermas, where there's a group, a well-informed group, distant from these perceptions, that is critical, that is based mostly on writings, on thinking, and so on and so forth. My impression is whether or not there ever was an age that really was so dominantly characterized by this Öffentlichkeit, by this public sphere. What you see now is that the show of media, the role of media and politics, creates a level of convergence which with the patterns that I've been describing in my book. It's how you it's the mise-en-scène of power. It's how you present yourself, and it's even more extreme, I would say, in modern televised society than it's in my in the world that I've been looking at. But there's also, as I think you pointed out, the not only the individuals in power, but also the notion. You can say that's more from the other side. People who are in power, or families who are in power, also tend to somehow try to do what their dynastic predecessors did, maybe make sure that their children too will have some sort of privileged position or have some sort of powerful position even. And we have American political dynasties, we have business dynasties, where of course inheritance is easier to organize than succession to high office. We have modern authoritarian regimes, that the North Korean would be the prime example, maybe, where succession is just very thinly disguised. So I think in all political systems, there's this. There's the personal connection and there's the family basis. And as you point out, lobbyism, no political system can exist, I would assume, without distribution of honors, this is an old term maybe, but I use it for our age as well. Any political power can be defined in terms of access still. Who has access to nominations, to certain redistribution of wealth, of all sorts of decisions? And the fact that you see lobbyists moving to the political centers, that is just the same world that I've been looking at in my book. This is about redistribution of all sorts of things, about political centers that define their raison d'être is basically the redistribution. It's almost a definition of how political systems work. And there too, I see some consonants. What my most difficult issue, and I find it very difficult to phrase, is, of course, there's a universal model of political freedom that we would adhere to, that you and I would adhere to, I think, that you would find as your define as your own ideal. Still, you know that there are environments. You know, for instance, that the Chinese Communist current form will have a high level of acceptance among the population. Or you will know that certain regimes that you find distasteful, let's say Vladimir Putin, will have, of course, he manipulates press and everything, will have a certain support among the population at large. And that's a problem in a way, because you get an... I wonder about and this is really difficult to phrase because I don't want to somehow either pose as somebody who stresses universal ideals on one hand, and this is how the world should be. Yes, I think I have an ideal there, but I also think you should try to see how a society functions, how a different society functions, how you can move from your universal ideas to getting an understanding of the local contexts, of the reasons why in these different societies forms of leadership can lead to a certain acceptance, not only on the basis of coercion, that of course is a prime force, but maybe also in other ways, and how you can look back at your own society and find out whether it's not a bit mixed there too. Of course, I think there are major differences, but I'm hesitant both between past and present and between different regions of the world to turn them into a picture that is too massively black and white.
Well, it's a tough one to get your head around. I mean, if you look at the Enlightenment, you've got this tension between tolerance and universals. You've got this idea of, you know, that there should be standards that humans are treated in terms of rights, but at the same time, all contexts are different, and how do you judge that? Like, I had a podcast, my last podcast is a book about world history, and I asked the authors the question about what do you do with societies that hold very different values on things like gay marriage the treatment of women, or, I mean, how do you balance that versus kind of Western ideals? And I made the comparison, like, you know, Samuel Huntington's basic argument in Class of Civilizations is that Westerners basically take their ideals and call them universals. So is it Eurocentric? Is it to call out, you know, like a country like Uganda and their horrific treatment of homosexuals? Is that some form of imperialism to tell them to stop it? Or is it, I mean, these are complex questions that we don't have time to get into, but that issue you addressed, I think, is a good one to think about. Yeah.
I think the extremes are clear, but so where in the middle, somewhere between black and white, where things are really touching, it gets tricky, and you have to be very careful. And this is the whole point of history and anthropology for me. It's always zooming in and zooming out. And always also, let's say, moving to very different worlds. And 17th century France for me is as different from my contemporary world as maybe other parts of the globe are. First, you have to see the standards of the locals and understand how they work. And this could be a shock at times. Then you move back to your own culture or to your own environment, and again you have to adapt and see, well, I see it's quite different, but now with this experience of what I've seen, I recognize certain aspects in my contemporary world that weren't visible to me before. And I think this back and forth, this zooming in, zooming out, moving out of your world and into your world is just one of the joys of history and anthropology, and also one of the joys that makes it for me interesting to look at the contemporary world with a different view. But that doesn't give me very strong or extreme judgments on it. It's just, sure, as you say, it's very difficult to get your arms around this.
Yeah, and I will say, I mean, I've taken so much of your time, and I've got one more question after this. This observation, when I read chapter 4, I read it a couple days ago, and I sat down and I just couldn't get out of my mind the 1984 presidential election in terms of how power is represented, when almost all the polls showed that Americans didn't like Ronald Reagan's policies, but they treated him like some type of democratic king.
Yeah.
He literally at one point went to NASCAR races with cowboy hats on and pretended to drink beers, and people were going wild. They were going wild over him. Even though most of the polls show they didn't like his stance toward unions, they didn't like supply side economics as implemented, they thought he was, you know, putting too much emphasis on nuclear weapons. But the fact that he would show up at NASCAR events or horse races you see, with the cowboy hat on chopping wood, people ate it up. And that's kind of what some of these kings were going for with the ritual and image, beyond the fact that if peasants rebelled for lack of food, they might whack them.
Yeah, no, it's totally true. Yeah. I've been thinking of these things too. Actually, sort of also the whole choreography of visits, of meetings, of all sorts of things that we tend to look back on history and say, well, this was all ceremonialized and ritual and see how silly. But of course, in our own age too, it's not only is it highly organized, is this spontaneity highly organized, but also people take it immensely seriously.
Yeah.
So, I can only underline your points. This brings together these worlds that we tend to position at extremes. Yeah.
Very much so. And once again, thank you for speaking with me. I enjoyed the book. Anyone who teaches world history or is interested in world history should definitely pick up and read your book and grapple with the questions. It's easy to follow. It's organized well, and I think you did an excellent job on it. But before we leave, I've got one more question. I was wondering if you could tell the listeners what your future plans are in terms of teaching or scholarship or whatever you might be doing.
Yeah, that brings me back to the zooming in and zooming out. What I really like about my profession is that you, in teaching as well as in research, is that you can, at times, you have to really go into the archives, go into the materials, feel very close to sort of the figures in history that you're looking, concentrate on. I never concentrate on one case, I always compare. So I would want to go back to regions where I know the languages, where I can read the manuscripts and really produce more work in this line, so closer to Europe. On the other hand, I am really determined to go on, sort of, in one way or another, doing global history, but trying to define themes. And I think another subject could be the intermediary, so I'm not looking at the top of society now, but the intermediary groups that are so essential. In any larger scale political entity throughout history, how are they functioning? How do they relate to the center? So the points we've just briefly touched upon, I might just consider working on in a global scope later on. But for the moment, I might just also write a very short textbook on a dynasty as a global phenomenon, if much shorter and much more, I won't say superficial. So I've been discussing this with a publisher, and I would want to do that, just write in maybe in 30,000 words, and then starting earlier and including the contemporary age about some of the essential conclusions that we've been discussing today. Yeah.
I think cogent is a good way to put it. As far as with the textbook you are, direct and right to the point
Yeah.
is that sounds like it would be a good project. Well, once again, thank you for speaking with me, and I wish you the best of luck down the line.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for giving me this opportunity. I really greatly appreciated that.
No problem. It was my pleasure. Take care.